This meeting is now being recorded.
Hello, this is the American Immigration Lawyers Association, Rome District Chapter. This is the Practicing Law Committee, Practicing Law Abroad Committee of the Chapter. My name is Clayton Cartwright. I am the chair of the Practicing Law Abroad Committee for 2012 to 2013. I have with me my fellow committee member, Claire Nilsson, as well as RDC member, Dan Berger, and our special guest panelist, Lauren Cohen from eCounsel, who happens to also be a an RDC member. Lauren, Claire, and Dan, thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Lauren, to get things started here, can you just give us a brief explanation of your practice and how that practice integrates with the practices of our members?
Sure. Thank you, Clayton. As Clayton said, my name is Lauren Cohen. My company is called eCounsel. We've probably had some interaction with a lot of Rome District chapter members, and I'm a chapter member myself. I'm an active AILA member. I have been for a couple years now, and I am a practicing attorney for, a little too long to mention. And my practice migrated into developing business plans, and for the past 2.5 years, that's been the sole focus of my practice. We started off just doing non-immigrant visa business plans for E's and L's mainly, and now we've migrated into doing the visa business plans for EB-5. My team is comprised of attorneys, fellow attorneys, and other professionals such as PhDs, CPAs, MBAs. My whole team is professionals of some caliber or other, and we work collaboratively to create business plans for the different types of visas. We actually write them for all types of visas, including, for example, some startup H-1Bs, and we offer a variety of ancillary services as well, such as market or feasibility studies, pro formas, which are obviously not done by me, but my CPA, and a variety of complementary consulting services. Clayton, does that sound about like what you would like me to explain?
Sure. Thanks, Lauren. And before we get too far along here, I didn't even give the title in the intro. This is Critical Business Plan Issues for Investor Visas, of course, as one can might surmise from that very good introduction from Lauren. In this, as a deviation from our prior podcast, I'm going to take less of a active role in questioning, and I'm going to turn over to Dan Berger for the first question to Lauren.
Okay. Thanks, Clayton. Lauren, I think it seems as if someone in your business would be involved in many different stages. There's obviously the drafting of the business plan, but I thought maybe we could take a step back and think about the pre-business planning. In what ways would someone like you be involved with thinking about a potential investment or structuring a potential investment before we even get to the point of trying to develop a business plan for a specific visa purpose? Let's say you have somebody come to you who says they have X amount of money and a good idea. How might you be involved in that?
Well, Dan, thank you for the question. It all depends on the stage that the investor is at in terms of business planning, obviously, and also how involved the immigration attorney is and or if they have a corporate attorney, which we always recommend to help them to structure the business. I myself was a corporate lawyer before I entered into the immigration realm, so I have a lot of experience with that, but I have to be very careful because we're not providing legal services, we're providing business consulting and business planning services. So it's kind of a catch-22 where I might know the answers, but sometimes I have to avoid providing the answer and instead defer to their attorneys to give them the legal advice. However, we can certainly help them to structure the business model and orient the business properly to make sure that it's a viable business for an ERL or EB-5 purpose based on our experience. The beauty of working with a team like ours is that we get incoming business plans referred to us by attorneys from all over the country and all over the world. You name it, we've had a business plan either come from that country or an investor come from the country. I can't even think of any that's an exception. Probably there are many. And so we've seen a lot of different types of businesses and different types of business plans. And we know also what USCIS likes or tends to like and doesn't like. And you follow the waves, because obviously everybody and their brother in the past couple of years has wanted to invest in the real estate market, especially residential. Sometimes USCIS doesn't like that. There's a lot of tech businesses. So we have to, what our role is to help to guide to a certain degree the business developer, business owner, entrepreneur in the right direction without providing the legal advice.
That's great. Lauren, thanks for that. And I guess as well, I know, Dan, you had communicated a point about, just to follow up on that, about different counselors wanting specific formats as well. We traded some correspondence about that pre-podcast. Lauren, would you care to comment on that?
Sure. Well, unfortunately or fortunately, almost every consulate has different rules. I'm sure as RDC members, most of you know that the British consulate is the most stringent in terms of their requirements for non-immigrant investor visas and the business plan. And for the most part, the business plan requirements in the UK govern are governed by almost matter of whole level requirements, which is similar to an EB-5 business plan requirement. So in a UK consulate business plan, it's actually a mandatory requirement, and it has to meet certain standards, such as the pro forma, the projections have to be sourced with external verifiable sources, which doesn't mean pulling data from Newsweek. It actually means you have to have a government or quasi-government source, for example. They have to have a marketing plan. Its marketing plan is a part of most business plans, but in the UK standard, it's a higher threshold that has to be met. Whereas you might be looking at somewhere, I'm not going to name names, but there are many consulates that are much more lax in terms of they just want a business plan, and sometimes the client throwing together a business plan can actually get by. But I will say one thing. I have noticed, working with as many different attorneys from as many different places as we do, and dealing with as many different consulates as we do, that the migration is up. In other words, we're moving towards the higher common denominator of the UK consulate than moving down from that. So the threshold or the diligence is becoming that much higher, and the bar has been raised.
Great. No, that's very, very helpful. It's always an increase in migration is certainly it's helpful for all of us. I'm sure we all have a vested business interest, our own vested business interest in that. So as long as it's inbound to the U.S. Now, Claire, I want to turn it over to you for a question.
Yes. You were speaking before a little bit about sort of the difference in marketing plans and the type that you'd see in different places, and you spoke a little bit about sort of the types of external sources that can be used to back up projections. In terms of the structure of a business plan, do you use different sorts of structures according to the types of visa category in which the applicant is applying, and maybe if you could talk a little bit about, you know, how those structures would differ, for example, between, say, an E, an L, and an EB-5, and whether there are any real no-nos that need to be avoided in terms of content and structure.
Sure. Okay, I'll try my best, Claire. Thank you for the question. So, absolutely, there are differences between different types of business plans. Okay, let's leave the EB-5 because that's a completely separate animal from the non-immigrant setting. So in an E and an L, in an E, you know, it's also about the focus of the business plan. In an E, just like in an E petition, the focus is on the investor and the investor's the qualification, and that the investment is not marginal. It has to be substantial. And how do you quantify that? It's very hard to quantify. It depends on the business. In an E or an L, the marketing plan is that much more important because you have to show that over the course of a certain, you know, 5 years, let's say, which is what the projections usually cover, 5 years in an E. And this is an E2 more than an E1, and I'll talk about E1s very briefly. But in an E2 setting, you have to focus on making sure that the business is not just to replace the investor's income or provide an income for the investor and the family. It has to do more. It has to create jobs. It has to have some benefits, some economic impact benefits. So the marketing plan is that much more important in an E than in an L, where you don't have to prove that same level of income. You have to satisfy the requirement about the actual visa beneficiary satisfying an executive or managerial role in the foreign entity and an executive or managerial role in the U.S. entity. So the focus of the business plan is different, and therefore the sections that we cover in the business plans are different. Now, prior to the podcast, we discussed a little bit about moving from one to the other, and this is very common, especially in an E2 to an L1 or vice versa. What happens oftentimes is a client will come to me, and they have been advised that they qualify for an L, but yet once they leave their foreign country, the business is really going to be defunct. So they really don't qualify for an L, because that's one of the requirements, is that the business has to continue to exist and thrive. Thrive is obviously a subjective word, but in any event, so oftentimes what happens is we'll look at the business once they come to us, and we might then have a conversation with the immigration attorney and say, because of our, you know, breadth of experience in this, we might actually say, maybe we need to reconsider if this is an L or an E or vice versa. And then the business plan, even though we may have started it following track one to the E, we may have to redirect that into track two to the L. And redirecting it to the L would mean then changing up the focus. But probably about, I'd say, 75% of the business plan is still going to be relevant. It's just a matter of changing the focus and adding some sections, removing some, and so on and so forth. In an E1 setting, business plans are less common, I think, although becoming more common. And there's a different level of proof involved, because all you really have to prove is substantial trade with the foreign country. One thing, though, that a lot of people that do E1s, that do E1s kind of overlook, and this is in terms of something that's developing, is that what happens if that relationship with the foreign company changes? What happens if there's a problem? What happens if the foreign company goes bankrupt and you no longer have that trading relationship? Well, suddenly your E1 is compromised. So what we try to do in our business plan for E1 is talk about alternative negotiations, alternative sources that are possibly available. They're not only talking about marketing within the U.S. to market the product, but also creating the relationships with potential foreign company distributors or manufacturers, as the case may be, to replace the loss if that does happen, so that the E1 status can still be retained. Oh, and definite no-nos. Let me just address that. One thing that we really try to avoid in our business plan is making absolute promises. This is particularly true in an L1 startup, because in an L1 startup, you have to obviously go back. It's a year, and in a year you have to get a renewal. Now, because of all the economic changes in the U.S., there's been a lot of times that clients have come back to us a year later and they have to have a business plan rewritten because they haven't done all of the things they said they were going to do. So one thing that we try to do, as much as we say, like, it's all about intention versus actual promises, and this comes from 8 years of writing non-immigration business plans, the more promises you make, the more likely you are to have a problem. But if you intend to do things and you say the plan is and so on, You really try to give yourself a little bit of leeway, because you can't control all of the circumstances. That's one thing I would say.
Lauren, thanks. Thank you very much for that. And Dan, I just received an email from you here. Would you ask a question of Lauren or have a comment?
Well, I think maybe what I'll do is I'll ask a broader question, and then maybe add that subject to the email on at the end. But, Lauren, I imagine you, like all of us, get relatively common questions along the lines of, should I file in the United States or at a consulate? And obviously that's something that the attorney and the business planner might both be weighing in on. Some consulates, as you mentioned, are harder than others. Some may be more likely to give 5 years than others because of reciprocity or policy. And sometimes there is a possibility of doing a change of status or an extension of status in the United States. So I guess my general question for you is, have you seen any trends about processing in the United States and filing an I-129? Over the last couple of years, the Immigration Service has has hired entrepreneurs in residence. You can see, if you Google that, you can see that they have hired actual business people to sit at CIS and try to inform the examiners and improve the quality of adjudications. But in terms of easier or harder or general trends, do you see anything in these different visa types?
I would say the answer is yes. I think that an E2, an L1 startup tends to be the easiest one to get, but the hardest one to keep. For obvious reasons, it's 1 year. The E2 is a good one to get, and it's not, if you could prove the substantial investment and have a good business plan, you're going to get your E2 most likely, but the problem is it doesn't lead to a green card, which is ultimately what most people's goals is, to get the green card. A lot of people that I've been working with over time have started with an E or an L for that matter, and then once they're here, they migrate into the EB-5. I'm actually at an EB-5 conference right now, and EB-5 is becoming more and more and more popular as people are investing more money in the U.S. If you can get in a certain areas, you only need to invest $500,000, and as long as you're hiring the 10 people and satisfying the other requirements, it's a good direction to go. But again, I don't think that's the question you're asking. I think that what you're asking is in terms of like within the U.S. versus outside of the U.S. And I honestly don't have an answer, Dan, because what tends to happen with my role is I'm brought in to write the business plan. I write the business plan. I sometimes help with the visa. I always find out what happens with the visa, but I don't necessarily know the process from the time that they approve the business plan until they go to the consulate or they submit the documents to CIS and get the approval, God willing. And so far, for the most part, I've heard only about approvals. I don't hear about the other side, and hopefully there are none. Does that kind of answer your question?
It does. And I guess I'm, I'll just throw out here that in general, it seems that there's been a perception that filing in the United States is restrictive in that you can't travel without filing again when you leave, and that you will only get 2 years maximum. But on the other hand, for a newer business, it may be somewhat easier to get the E2 approved. But I think we're just going to have to watch the trends and see what the trickle down is from these entrepreneurs and residents.
Well, another thing that I will say is I think that creating a more professional level of adjudication is a very good thing, because it actually makes a lot of sense, because instead of it being just lay people that have absolutely no business sense at all, you're having some level of review. And, you know, at the end of the day, as much as these people want to get in here, what's the good of them getting in here if they're just going to have to turn around and leave anyway? Because then they're just going to have to pick up their family again. So it actually is good that there's a higher threshold to pass. With that being said, one of the things we wrote an article about a couple of months ago was about the high incidence of RFEs in L1A settings. And the reason why is because it's the main reason for L1A RFEs that we've seen over time, and it's been decreasing a little bit because I think that the attorneys are more cognizant of it, is that the prospective visa beneficiary doesn't qualify under the L1A definitions and regulations. So I think that is something that if the business plan and the petition support the position and the capacity of the prospective beneficiary, then you can overcome that, and then your RFE will be avoided. And just briefly to touch on the RFE issue, which I know we'll discuss further, the level of RFEs that I've seen coming across my desk is actually down versus what it was, a year and a half ago. It was really high. I would say 50% of my cases were RFE-related cases, and now it's probably down to about 10. I don't know if that's just because that's what passes my desk, or because the clients are responding themselves, or they're not business plan related items. I don't know, but that's just a trend that I've seen.
Great, Lauren. Thank you for that. Claire, would you care to comment or inquire?
I don't think I need to comment on that point precisely, but I was wondering, in terms of sort of different agencies and different visa categories, have you noticed any preferences in terms of stylistic elements to the business plan in different industries or going into different agencies?
Well, I guess to a certain degree, Claire, yes. But again, you know, because we're the submitter, we're the preparer, as opposed to the quarterback, the immigration attorney that actually either submits or you know, submits with the client. I don't see it quite as much, but I know that there are some consulates. I think the Spain consulate will only take a business plan up to a certain number of pages, and then other consulates, if your business plan is too short, I can't remember, there was a consulate not that long ago, which they didn't even read the business plan. It was not mine. We did get an RFE on this one. That's how we came into the picture. The client had written their own business plan. It was 5 pages with 10 pages of projections and no assumptions, and the projections made absolutely no sense, and the consulate didn't even read it because they said there's no way you can have a 5-page business plan. There's some clients that submit 2-page business plans and think it's enough. And you know what? Sometimes if you get the right adjudicator, it could be. But more and more the trend is towards, as I say, this higher level of a higher bar, or a higher level of diligence, a higher common denominator. And as the restrictions are being imposed that much more, the requirement is becoming that much more onerous. And that helps our business because then the people need us more and realize that they can't write their own business plan, or they shouldn't, at least.
Great. Lauren, I remember an email passing around the RDC listserv about that. Somebody was taking a tax return, and it was involving, I think Madrid, where they were taking tax returns and putting 4 pages onto one for purposes of the filing. So I kind of chuckled at that because sometimes I have a hard enough time reading at a 1-to-1 ratio in my old age. I'm not sure about shrinking that stuff down. Great. Well, one thing I wanted to mention, or at least sort of comment and inquire as well, and it's sort of more along the lines of the beginnings of the process. Lauren, in terms of, like, the players that are being involved here, and from the tax perspective, I see these things coming through, and I look for sources and individuals, your businesses like yourself, to refer out to. Are you seeing what's the trend in terms of the client? Are you just seeing a referral coming in from the immigration lawyer of a client, and then you have to sort of marry them up with an accountant, a bookkeeper, a corporate lawyer? Or are they coming in fully accountant and lawyered up in the process? And maybe you can comment upon that in terms of referral relationships. Yeah.
Quite honestly, it runs the gamut. Okay. It all depends on the lawyer that's referring the business in. You know, the solo practitioner, multidisciplinary immigration attorney that does a little bit of business will probably send me a client that needs referrals to an accountant, one of whom I have on my team, or to a corporate attorney, or whatever the case may be. They may even need to have their basic LLC or corporation established and all of that type of thing. So that happens. And then, of course, there's the more sophisticated ones from the larger firms, and not always the larger firms, but just the firms that focus, you know, there could be the boutique firms that focus more in business and are more used to all of the pieces that the investor or the prospective beneficiary needs, and they will come to us all suited up. So it does run the gamut. We have access to great referral sources. This is particularly true, and I'll just pipe in, because I am at the CB5 conference, and it's becoming such a huge part of the practice of immigration law. In the EB-5 setting, there can be up to 6 components. you have an economic study, you have a private placement memorandum, which is a securities document for various types of projects. You have a five-year pro forma, minimum five-year pro forma. You have a market study. You have the immigration law piece. And, of course, you have my piece. Now, it's become more and more evident that the business plan is the single most important document, the least expensive document, I will add, but the single most important document in that whole puzzle, because it basically ties everything together and then goes into the petition. But the point is that we have access to all of those referral sources within my team, or the client will come to us with all of those. But we can't finish the business plan without all the pieces being in place. This is a little less relevant in the E&L settings because it's not quite as mandated or structured. So there's a little more flexibility. And sometimes we also, if the client just needs basic projections and they have a very strong business, we can do the projections without even utilizing services of my CPA. You know, I have myself and two other people on our team that can do the basic 5 or 3 year projections depending on what's needed. So again, runs the gamut.
Yeah, and I find that the genesis of that question is I'm finding in more and more cases here that you know, I'm talking to clients about operating efficiencies among, you know, people in firms with whom I've worked in the past. And so I'm sure you're probably dealing with the same issue, or you may be dealing with the same issue on certain services there. If a new client was referred in and they bring in, you know, their own person who may be very good, there may be some inefficiencies that are there, maybe ones that are easily overcome, maybe not so easily overcome. But I know that obviously, I find the practice of immigration law is becoming more and more, dare I say, comprehensive. I dare not say holistic because I was condemned for using that term at one time a couple of years ago. Yeah, so that's sort of the genesis of the question. We've got time for one more question here, and I know, Dan, again, you've circulated the question here, and I'm going to leave the option to you of asking that question or asking a new one of Lauren.
Okay, well, I think rather than leaving a lot of questions in the mind of the podcast listeners, I will just throw out the idea that as of the last couple of years, the national interest waiver has the self-petition has an option for has a specific option for entrepreneurs, and there's some very good guidance on the immigration website, and that's sort of a cutting edge area in business plan development, and just so people don't wonder. But because it doesn't relate to too many people, I think I'll ask the more general question of Lauren, which is, what are the major differences between immigration and traditional business plans? It's not uncommon for us to have an MBA graduate come to us and say, well, I've got a business plan. I did it for a class. And when I look at those, first of all, they're not geared. The projections seem to be pretty wild to me and often inflated. But what are the major differences between an immigration and a traditional business plan?
So, very briefly, Dan, thank you. That's a very, very, very relevant question, and I'll just add a little piece to that question, which is what happens when a client prepares their own business plan, period, if I may. But regarding the major differences, so when you coming from 8 years of a background of writing more traditional startup entrepreneur capital raising-oriented business plans and then migrating into this for various obvious reasons, such as being an immigrant myself and practicing in this field, the more traditional business plans are focused on a return on the investment. They're focused on why would somebody want to invest in my business and going as thin as possible on your employees because you want to show that you can run this business without having to expend too much on staff and so on. So the thinner that the expenses are, the better it is because you're going to show a higher return on your investment. So the prospective investor, venture capital company, angel investor might want to invest. That completely flies in the face of an immigration business plan where the focus is on, okay, the investment on the part of the actual person that's applying is substantial and not marginal. and you're going to create jobs and have a beneficial economic impact. It's kind of like they kind of on their face challenge each other. So when you bring a traditional business plan to us, and the same thing goes for the projections, because as you said, Dan, some of the projections on these traditional business plans are very far out, and there's no way that USCIS will approve that, besides which you shouldn't overestimate, because then you'll underdeliver, and then you might lose your chance for renewal. It's always better to be conservative in these business plans, these immigration business plans, because you're not trying to raise capital. You're not trying to entice somebody to invest in your business. You're trying to entice somebody to give you the opportunity to build your business and create success. So you have to show success, but you don't want the numbers to be outlandish, okay? With that being said, I think at this point in time, about 30% of our work comes from existing business plans that are brought to us for rewrites. And everybody thinks that if they have a business plan, it's going to save them a whole lot of money and it should be everything that we need and all we have to do is do a little editing and it's done. Well, I will tell you that that is so much not the case. It's exactly the opposite, actually. I prefer somebody to come to me without an existing business plan because what happens is that we end up having to siphon through that existing business plan to get the information that we garner, which we garner from our questionnaire. Client has existing business plan, often doesn't want to fill out the questionnaire because they say, well, all the answers are in my business plan. Well, we aren't going to extract all the information. We just can't. I mean, our role is to take client information, and this is particularly relevant to the marketing plan because all the clients think that we're going to write the marketing plan for them. And I would really love to be an expert at marketing for every single type of business that comes across my door, but then I wouldn't be an expert at business planning. So the fact is that the client has to give us the information in a structured, cohesive way. The best way is following through our questionnaire. They give us a business plan. It ends up making our workload that much harder. This is particularly true in an EB-5 setting, which they, I guess, five out of every half of the clients probably write their own business plans and then realize they're not matter of hope compliant because their lawyer tells them. And they come to us and they're all upset because they've already spent all this time and money. And then we have to do a complete rewrite and overhaul. So at the end of the day, the best thing is to come to us with raw data and follow our process because we have a process in place just like you as attorneys do. And if the client follows the process, they're going to get what they want. If they don't follow the process and you're kind of thrown off the track and you can't rein the client in, it makes it virtually impossible for you to structure the petition properly and achieve the visa that they want.
Well, Lauren, thank you very much for that. Wow, you're my compatriot here in believing in advanced planning and prevention as opposed to cleanup. I often joke as an attorney that I'm often as much a janitor in the legal context as I am a lawyer. In any event, that's all we have time for today for this particular podcast. This podcast is Critical Business Plan Issues for Investor Visas. I want to thank our special guest panelist, Lauren Cohen. Also, our other panelists here, Dan Berger, who's an RDC member, Claire Nilsson, who is a member of the Practicing Law Abroad Committee, along with me, and also, of course, an RDC member. Since this is the last podcast of the year, I also would like to thank our fellow committee members who couldn't make it on the call here. That would be Jonathan Davis and Janice Flynn, and, of course, our ExecCom member, Sal Savateri. Thank you very much for your attention, and have a great day.